Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Is that working?
Coming along tonight, microphone working. If you can't hear at any stage, let us know. It's great to have Dr. Gabrielle Gooder here tonight. I'll introduce her very briefly. Dr. Gooder is an urban sociologist and postdoctoral research fellow with the Social Justice and Social Change Research Centre at the University of Western Sydney. Her research interests and expertise are in housing issues, community development and political action, with an emphasis on communities within Western Sydney. And we've asked her to talk tonight on the topic of the lifestyles war and the aspirationals of Sydney's West. Dr. Gooder, you're very welcome. Thank you.
I've no doubt that Kath and Kim are partly responsible for the media interest in my essay, Once Were Westies, published earlier this year in the Griffith Review, when I noticed there's some copies out there on the table. They're very good marketing, the Griffith Review. Research-based, it seemed here was evidence that Kath and Kim might really exist in the expanse of new housing on the fringes of Australian cities. The essay introduced the reader Stacey and Glenn, real people, fictitious names, who no doubt disappointed those expecting Bogon stereotypes. Quintessential aspirational couple, Stacey and Glenn moved into their substantial double-storey blonde brick and tile home in 1998. They lost money on their first home, located adjacent to a public housing estate in Campbelltown, and thought that Harrington Park near Camden would prove a more secure investment. The term aspirational is not mine. It entered the political lexicon earlier this decade to describe a seemingly new constituency on the urban fringe of Australian cities. If we have to call this group something, Acorn's less judgmental geo-demographic classification flourishing families, or perhaps mosaic suburban optimists, would be more appropriate. At least these categories are based on rigorous statistical analysis rather than on moral values. Developed by the Fairfax family on the Lake Sir Warwick Fairfax's Poll Hereford Stud, Harrington Park is a contemporary master plan community, an MPC, intended, according to the promotional material, to be a benchmark estate for the future growth of Western Sydney. Harrington Park is located within the Liberal-held federal electorate of Macarthur, some 50 kilometres southwest of Sydney's Central Business District. Between 2000 and 2003, I spent a number of months interviewing residents of Harrington Park as part of a study into community formation in this and other master planned estates in Western Sydney. Harrington Park essentially comprises second and third home buying middle to higher income families of Anglo-Christian Moors occupied in white collar service jobs or as self-employed tradesmen. Work-wise, production-wise, they're generally excluded from the global economy or are big players in it, and their local community-based interests inevitably reflect this. Most residents grew up in Sydney's western suburbs, although there are some interlopers from the Shire, attracted by the new housing and the peculiar belief that Camden is not really a suburb of southwest Sydney. Harrington Park is a low-density estate of large detached houses, some master-built rendered examples, but most project homes with features cherry-picked from bygone eras. Prim Georgian facades, Victorian fussiness, Queen Anne turrets, Federation finials and the occasional shady over-constructed California porch. With the provision of obligatory water tanks, front gardens are meticulous and lawns hold pride of place. There is an absence of domestic satellite dishes which proliferate in the more multicultural suburbs of Sydney's southwest. Restrictive covenants prevail here. The estate's formal entrance is impressive, with a wide, curving road stretching past tented acre parks and lakes, Streetscaping, particularly along the main thoroughfares, provides a formal feel, with mature deciduous trees dominating. It has well-resourced playgrounds and sports facilities, including a picket-fenced cricket oval and a network of well-maintained walkways, bike trails and picnic grounds. In her mid-30s at the time of interview, Stacey was friendly, energetic and confident. Although she described her household as being chaotic, she actually appeared to be in masterful control of her domestic, social and business arrangements. Stacey liked to chat. Her language skills drew attention to her lack of education and her working class roots. Her father was a builder, and her father-in-law worked in a railway workshop. Stacey left school in year 10 and went to work as a secretary. Her husband left school in year 9 to take up employment with a tradesman. Glenn was a good-looking man in a manpower sort of way, and with a glass of good red in hand, he talked to me with friendly familiarity, the way tradesmen do, peppering my name with his throughout his sentences. And like his wife, he appeared very confident about his social position and content with his lifestyle and his achievements. The couple worked long hours. Glenn often worked a 14-hour day, but were financially rewarded, earning over $150,000 a year from their air conditioning business. Prior to purchasing this business, they'd worked for others, gaining the skills and experience they would need to operate it. And like all the residents I interviewed, hard work was the couple's core value. It is a value that's been passed on to them from their own parents, and one which they hope to pass on to their young son. As Stacey put it, I want him to learn to do a decent day's work for a decent day's pay. We were both brought up that way. Nothing we've got was ever handed to us. We worked bloody hard for everything. The couple's pulling ourselves up by our bootstrap imagery was common amongst the residents I met with in Harrington Park. Residents were keen to tell me of their success through toil, determination, resourcefulness and sacrifice. Rather than perceiving themselves as prosperous people, having ridden the crest of buoyant economy, property appreciation and easy access to finance over the boom decade, they perceived themselves as merely average Joe Blows. The self-made imagery also alluded to residents' general attitude towards people receiving social security, although they distinguished between the disabled, the deserving poor, and the unemployed bludgers, the undeserving poor. As Jenny, another resident of Harrington Park, married mother of four and part-time worker, explained, "We've had to work very hard for what we've got. We've never been given anything. So everything we've been able to achieve, we've been able to achieve together. And not through handouts or inheritance or anything like that. It's been through sheer blood and guts, really. Too many people wanting to have everything for free and the government owes me. I think the attitude doesn't achieve anything, you know. Let's face it, a lot of people do feel like that. The government owes me. Why should I work? I'll just spit out all these children and the government will pay for them." Welfare aside, the Harrington Park residents I interviewed and observed were generally a kind and generous lot, given to helping each other with landscaping, child mining and downing the odd beer or two over the back fence. They greeted each other when out walking and neighbours attended each other's pastor nights. Parents put great effort into raising good citizens. They volunteered at their children's school, at sporting clubs and local tree planting days. They encouraged their children to take up formalised extracurricular activities lest they fall into the wrong crowd. Harrington Park residents worked hard and their confidence stemmed from their identity as self-made people. Success was established through the passing on of family and work values rather than through education. One mother, raising two teenagers on her own, exemplified this distinction. Marion, a 42-year-old resident of Harrington Park, was a senior executive in a large corporation located in Western Sydney. She would get to work by 4:45 each morning in order to be home by 3 p.m. to start her second shift. Marion had risen to the top of her field through hard work rather than through education. She explained, "I know people who have the same position as me in other corporations, and most of them have big degrees attached to their names. But in saying that, I've worked hard and I've studied hard, although I haven't gone and furthered my tertiary education." Marion sent her children to a local private grammar school. Set them there for the values it professed, more so than for the educational advantage. "My older son," she says, "he's turned 15 in March. He's growing up, and I haven't had one problem with him. He's got really nice friends and parents of those friends. Oh, they're great kids. They're not disrespectful, and I think the school had a lot to do with the fact that my son is growing up to be a really nice young man. Whereas I look at my girlfriends who put their children through the state system and they're just having nightmares. It's terrible. When I asked Marion what aspiration she had for her children's future, she explained, "Oh, I'm not overly fussed. Like, I don't push them. The fact that because they go to a private school, I want them to become a doctor or a lawyer. Whatever career choice they make, I'll be happy and I'll support them 100%. Believing so strongly in self-sufficiency, the residents of Harrington Park were proud of their material achievements and despised people perceived to be society's slackers and freeloaders. They were a fairly homogenous group who shared a common set of values, social experiences and outlook. They reminded me very much of the moral middle class, described by Judith Brett in her analysis of the Menzies years. She wrote, the middle class is best understood as a projected moral community whose members are identified by their possession of particular moral qualities, political values and social skills. The moral qualities of individualism, self-sufficiency and the self-made, symbolised most powerfully through the ownership of status housing, and their loathing of unions, the unemployed and welfare recipients, locates the aspirations firmly within the camp of Menzies' forgotten people. John Howard recognised this, and for a time, until the fragility of contemporary ideological arrangements intervened, was able to gather them up into the Liberal fold. It's no coincidence, in Sydney at least, that the development of Greenfield Master Plan communities from the early 1990s paralleled the rise of Liberal voting hotspots, intense enough to turn formerly solid Labor electorates into swinging seats. In 1996, the fringe electorates of MacArthur and Camden and Lindsay and Penrith fell to the Liberals, with the latter falling back to the ALP in the Rudd slide of 2007. On the Central Coast, the electorate of Dobell fell to the Liberals in 2001 and back to the ALP in 2007. And in northwest Sydney, Greenway was wrested from the ALP in 2004 and remains in Liberal hands. Political analysts have argued amongst themselves about the significance of the aspirationals to Australian politics, but as we know, elections are won or lost on a mere handful of seats. Western Sydney has always had its moral middle class. Its members, however, were spread relatively thinly through the electorates, enabling the traditional party of the worker to be etched deep into the psyche and landscape of the region. The growth of master plan communities on the urban fringe has provided the moral middle class with a space of their own. Perhaps more importantly, MPCs have given this group a reason for not following the well-worn trail of successful Westies out to the leafy suburbs of Sydney's north and south. The MPC is the development apparatus through which high land values and development costs on the urban fringe are packaged up and marketed to higher income purchasers. From a socio-spatial perspective, the MPC is a conduit for creating determinedly middle-class suburbs out of what were previously considered low-income areas, befitting first home buyers and that lowbrow archetype, the Westie. The attraction of the MPC for the aspirationals is the expectation of physical and social segregation together with economic, cultural and ontological security. Protected from the antisocial character of nearby public housing estates and migrating incursions into their suburban suburbs, the new MPCs support the desire for like-minded residents to express their social power as a status group. The aspirational success, however, is contingent on wider social and economic opportunities and constraints, such as support for working mothers, the cost of housing finance, the provision of public infrastructure, particularly in regard to transport, and employment opportunities. Importantly, these concerns guide and tune the aspirational's pragmatic political antenna, confounding political analysts in the process. Interestingly, for all their effort and toil, the aspirational's are a ridiculed lot, disparaged as ignorant middle-class wannabes, lacking in taste, covetous, and as far as the academic Clive Hamilton is concerned, insatiable. There is a sense, too, that like their Westie predecessors, the aspirationals are not a particularly smart lot, easily gulled and duped into misrecognising their real class interests. Their suburbs are described as barren, their homes are mocked as McMansions, and the weight of responsibility for the nation's fetish for plasma TVs and SUVs is placed squarely on their shoulders. inner-city terrace-dwelling architect and social commentator Elizabeth Farrelly has made a career out of admonishing the aspirations and their values. Writing, for instance, if we want to sprawl our cities across the landscape, live in a McMansion, drive an SUV, leave the lights or the hose on or the TV on all night, we do precisely that. It may cost us or the planet, but it's our right to make that choice. It is difficult to understand why the aspirations attract so much derision, and why are the attributes of hard work, drive and wealth creation held so highly in the privileged suburbs of Sydney's north and east, yet held to ridicule when practiced by the aspirations of Sydney's west? More intriguingly, why do Sydney's privileged citizens hold the aspirations to a higher standard of moral behaviour than they hold for themselves? Take, for instance, effort and ambition. Usually regarded as positive attributes, when employed by the aspirationals, they become grasping and greedy. Where substantial homes and water-guzzling gardens of Sydney's leafy suburbs are recognised as symbols of success, in Sydney's west they are considered sprawl, wasteful of space and utilities, and an aesthetic blight on the landscape. While clinging to their harbourside homes, beaches and cooling sea breezes, the residents of Sydney's east condemn the affection aspirationals have developed for air conditioning and in-ground pools. Despite the proximity to the inordinate concentration of publicly subsidised cultural facilities, residents of the inner west snigger at the proliferation of home theatres in Sydney's outer west. Greenhouse gas production, growing carbon footprints and urban sprawl are laid at the feet of those wasteful, materialistic aspirationals. From the 1960s, the disparaging of Western Sydney, most notably through the portrayal of the delinquent Westie, facilitated the development of a rhetorical relationship between working class culture and place that remains to this day. The classic Westie, circa 1970, was indigent, uneducated, uncultured. A character of Anglo-Celtic origin living in the vast, seemingly homogenous flatlands to the west of the city. The checked flannelette shirt symbolised the attire, and vandalism, cheap drink and hotted up cars the behaviour. Westie became a rhetorical device to designate the other Sydney, a region spatially, culturally and economically different from the more prosperous and privileged Sydney-siders of the north and east. Stereotypes, derisions and taunts kept the residents of Western Sydney politically disempowered and culturally, economically and spatially contained. The Westie pejorative struggles these days to compete with an increasingly complex mix of identity politics, youth subcultures and ethnicity. In fact, the term is more likely to be used as a positive source of identity by Western Sydney residents themselves than to be used by outsiders as a term of abuse. Nevertheless, confirming and reaffirming Western Sydney as the other established it as a chimera against which the rest of Sydney could positively and confidently appraise itself. The aspirationals challenged this status quo. Their use of status-oriented material acquisition challenges the perceived entitlement of Sydney's privileged residents to unrestrained consumption. Their petrol-guzzling four-wheel drives and large air-conditioned houses with countless downlights and wide-screen TVs challenge the unfettered claims of the privileged to the world's dwindling supplies of energy. The aspirational's enthusiasm for value-based private schooling challenges the claim of the privileged to a better quality education. And their political clout challenges the monopolisation of political influence. Perhaps most importantly, however, their master plan privatopias challenge the apparent right of the privileged to segregate themselves away from the other status-oriented spatial utopias. On further consideration, then, the disparaging of the aspirationals seems to be a response to this group violating the assiduously constructed image of Western Sydney by attempting to move beyond their allocated socio-economic position. A form of social pincer movement by the upper middle class. On the one hand, it is the reaction of Sydney's concrete caramel materialists who glare down Parramatta Road towards the damage masculinity has inflicted on their strategies for status distinction. Concrete caramel, according to Andrew West, refers to the style of fortress housing that cruise captains point out on their tours of Sydney Harbour, but which are also scattered through the suburbs of the inner west and concentrated in the east and the north. Such housing, West argues, indicates a character that craves privacy but which feels compelled to advertise economic success and status through flamboyant housing, cars, holidays and watercraft. materialists themselves are driven by intense competition to make partner in a law firm, to get their kids into trophy private schools, and most importantly, to keep ahead of those suburban aspirationals. On the other hand, it is the priggish response of West uber-educated, small-ill liberal, white weatherboard culturalists, also identified as Peter Saunders' opinionators, Brett's progressive middle class, and Howard's elites. The culturalists continue to resent 10 years of a constituency of ordinary intelligence and taste being fated by Howard and his dry-pressed Liberal government. In his 1942 Forgotten People broadcast, Menzies spoke of the moral middle class, of that constituency ground between the upper and nether millstones of the false class war. And some 60 years later, this constituency is again being ground, but by a different war. A war of self-righteous privilege between the Labour-leaning culturalists and the Liberal-voting materialists. And that is why ultra-culturalist Farrelly is comfortable censuring the material taste of both the good birders of Balmoral and Kellyville, who apparently can no longer see any horizon but only into each other's marbleised, gold-plated ensuites. The current global economic malaise will no doubt arrest the lifestyles war for a time. Nevertheless, the disparaging of the aspirationals by both columns in this war continues the World War strategy of reducing the vibrancy, creativity and complexity of Western Sydney down to the monotonous and mundane. And this has ramifications for the residents of Western Sydney. It affects the amount and the type of infrastructure and services both government and corporations are willing to invest in the region, restricting residents' opportunities and potential in the process. It is time for the condescending attitude to the lifestyles and values of the people of Western Sydney to be replaced with a more generous, enlightened understanding of the disparate communities within the region. Now that would be a moral victory indeed. Thank you.
Many thanks. Now, I must confess straight up that I like plasma TV, and on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock you can now watch Forum on ABC4. 2, which is Forum on ABC 2, which is channel 126, and the cameras here tonight are from Forum, so you've got to be very well behaved. So when the questions are asked, either Gabriel will repeat them or I'll repeat them, just so that Forum picks it up. Having said that, I should also say that there are some copies of the Griffith Review, which contains Dr. Gwither's chapter, and we've got that for sale outside at a very reasonable price. And now we come to questions and discussion. Just initially, you've spoken today about essentially Western Sydney, and you've highlighted a suburb, for example, of Kellyville, but to what extent does your thesis stack up with a similar kind of suburb and a similar part of another Australian capital city, say Western Melbourne or parts of Brisbane or Perth? Mm.
Well, one of the reason, and I hope that it sort of came out in the paper, although I heard a few different things going on there, but the reason we had this dilemma is because in the past the urban fringe was very much for low income. It was cheap to develop. It was a place where you could build your garage, live in that for a few years, build your house. Every time you had a child, you could stick an extra 5-bay bedroom on the back. And what's happened over the last, say, 15 years is that land supplies, particularly in Sydney, but also in other parts, particularly in Melbourne, I noticed that, so there was an article in the Australian today about that, the population growth, is that the land development has become very expensive on the urban fringe. And there's a number of reasons for this. There are the cost of infrastructure has been built into the cost of the development. The era of passing on government costs onto the end user through that privatisation, user pays, has affected the cost of land. The slowness in releasing land because of all the extra bureaucracy, whether it's environmental policies or whatever, has slowed down the release of land, so there was a pent-up demand. So what this has done is made the land on the urban fringe, whether it's in Perth or Melbourne or Brisbane or Sydney, it's made it expensive. And to be able to sell that land, developers have moved in with this concept of the master plan. So they're not just selling you a block of land or a subdivision, they're actually selling you a lifestyle. I call it value adding, so that the land becomes quite expensive and it's actually projected towards a certain group of people, concentrating them within these areas. So it's actually changed the nature, and that is why I suggest that it is actually a phenomenon that goes right around the country.
Thanks. And Barbara, if you just talk to the back of the room, and I'll just go there.
With this development of a more middle-class outer suburban cluster, what's the effect been on schools? Because I think some of the derision of the Westie or the Kath and Kim mentality is it's anti-intellectual and it doesn't have that kind of aspirational educational background. Has there been a change in through education?
Okay, could you just repeat that and then talk to the
I mean, private schools, public schools,
yes,
whatever.
We're talking about private.
Yeah, how is that changing the area?
How that has
I'm thinking of James Bruce High and things like that that have sprung up a little closer to town. And also private schools.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things have sort of happened. There's been sort of increase in master plan estate, but there's also been an increase in private schools. And I think it's not the sort of the high-end private school that's actually been developed, particularly in it during the late 90s and in the last 10 years or so. It's the low, the cheaper private Christian or perhaps Islamic sort of almost fundamental schools, biblical schools, etc. My son goes to one, so I feel quite able to talk about this. So in Western Sydney, we don't have the high-end type of private school, but there's a proliferation of low-end private schools. And what this is doing isn't really capturing that concept of education. It's actually it's capturing the concept of values. And I think that's what we are actually seeing. So people make the decision, if they can, to send their children to these schools, not because they want them to end up in an office block in a tie as a solicitor, but because they want to pass on particular values, and I'll try to bring that out in the paper. The other thing that it does is that people who can't quite afford the private school move, they make a decision, am I going to send my child to a private school or will I move into a better area? So they'll look at the master plan estate. For instance, in Harrington Park, there is a public school, and only kids from Harrington Park go to that public school. So it is a public school, but they feel it's sort of like a bit like a private school where they've got all the values sort of being replicated through the school. So they will move into Harrington Park if not, they will send their children to that private school.
You mentioned that the people that are now living in these kinds of suburbs have come from parents that used to be, you know, tradespeople and were sort of, if I understand you correctly, sort of lower down the socioeconomic ladder than they.
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. So where would you predict the children of these people will go on to migrate?
The question is, what about the children of the people that Dr. Bridges is talking about? The children of the aspirations.
Mm. I'm not a futurist. And I don't think anyone can tell what's going to happen, you know. Maybe we'll understand the future better after the next 12 to 18 months. But there's all sorts of predictions and analysts that will tell you what generation Y and Z and whatever it is after that, double A, I'm not sure. But it is very interesting whether, you know, they'll stay out there or whether, I presume just like already some sort of move into the city and go overseas and become global citizens and others sort of, you know, happy enough to stay out there and build a business or whatever out there. There probably won't be that humongous a change.
Question here.
Yes, I don't know if I can clarify this, but it seems to me when I meet a lot of left-wing intellectuals, they are, you know, in jobs like teaching, librarians, not actual in trades at all, but they are also proud of their background. As you know, Dan was in the railways, and I'm the first person in my family to get to university, but that has left them with a sort of, they are in now the middle class, but sort of still voting left, and still seeing themselves somehow champion the working class.
Yes. The suggestion is that left intellectuals are essentially working in professional jobs but still see themselves as champions of the working class.
Yeah, I think to some extent that's true. But I think that's why I wanted to draw on Andrew West's sort of idea of the culturalist, because with what's different now is that we have this information society, we've got, you know, the global economy, we've got the technology which allows us to, you know, have networks all over the world. And that has kind of divided, to some extent, to a great extent, you know, that groups of middle-class people. And that was the idea of trying to bring in that, like that culturalist, materialist divide, so that even though the culturalists, for want of a better word, or the left-leaning intellectuals, or the Bobos, I think they call them in America, you know, even though they might have come from those sorts of roots, some of them didn't, some of them didn't, and they sort of feel that people should take on that global kind of citizenship, and therefore are critical about people who don't have the same concerns as them. And I think that was sort of one of the things I was trying to get at as well, that, you know, at the end of the day, understand people's lifestyles before you go out and start, you know, criticising them. And why people who are, you know, hard-working, you know, decent people, and, you know, quite generous in most instances, you know, why they need to be so disparaged is the thing that I find, you know, quite annoying.
Yeah. You mentioned infrastructure in your talk. I'd just like to know if you can comment on the recent resurfacing this week of the Sydney Second Airport. I believe it's now being talked about in Richmond, obviously Western Sydney, and how that may impact on these aspirationals, as you mentioned.
Question about infrastructure, the impact on aspirationals, but in particular the Second Sydney Airport, which may be built in Richmond.
No, it's one of those sorts of things, you know, it's sort of like state Labor government promising a railway. Most people have switched off.
Sure.
And I'm sure they're not making too many decisions.
That's federal.
Well, same thing, you know, I mean, they've all got that land, the heritage land out there at Badgerys Creek, and I understand he wants to buy it back for $1 million.
But would that actually attract maybe more aspirationals if there was an airport they could fly into? Different type of person, perhaps.
Oh, look, I'm not really sure about that. From Western Sydney to get to Sydney Airport on the M5 than it is for people on the North Shore to get to the airport. You know, I don't think that is an issue. What is an issue are the types of industries that are attracted around it.
Sure.
So I presume that if it's going to go to Richmond, which it won't, it won't be in my life. Anyway, I presume that the global R will just stretch a little bit further out to, you know, and join up the two airports out that way.
That will attract industry and that will attract people.
So yeah.
You would have seen recent reporting that by George Megalogenis that 42% of Australian families receive some sort of welfare or income support. Mm. Now they're all over the country, but if things did become tough and the government had to cut back, do you think that the people you're talking about tolerate these benefits being cut? And also, I'm just wondering, do you have a view of the future? Do you think we will cut back more taxes and transfer payments become more prominent?
The question is about family payments and whether they might be cut, and if they were cut, how the aspirational groups would react to that.
I'm sure there's plenty of aspirational groups out there already who have been affected with family fee payments, with childcare. Everyone that's sitting on, it's over 150 or whatever it is, 1,000 or 100,000, whatever it is. But there's, you know, a large. You've only got to have two sort of good incomes, and you've already been cut out of that. So all those mums that were at home before who were picking up family B, you know, the mums will now just go out to work. So that's sort of already gone. That would, if anything further, we would assume that people are talking about that. But it's interest rates, I think, that are really the big thing. They can keep those down in terms of mortgage. They put so much more money in people's pockets. For the aspirations at the moment, we were just talking about this with Jerry earlier, that you know, these are boom times. We've had low interest rates. We've got low petrol, you know. It's not particularly a sorrowful thing. Now, unless you're going to retire fairly shortly, you know, there are some people who are doing okay. It depends how far we get, do go into recession and how deep that is. You know, down the track that may then affect them in terms of employment. But if they can keep their job, you know, they're actually doing better now than they were 12 months ago.
Such as a statement.
Okay, we've got to move on. Okay. Question here. Yeah. Yep.
I was just wondering how these people, when you interviewed them, in Harrington Park, which is like a little enclave, isn't it, within the whole area, how they view themselves vis-a-vis in the West. How do they feel? Do they feel as if they're denigrated too? What are their feelings?
The question is how people in Harrington Park view themselves? Do they feel denigrated or not?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think that's where that they don't feel denigrated too much by the aspirational stuff, because they don't get that caught up in the whole kind of political stuff. But the ones I grew up in Western Sydney had grown up with that Westie thing overhanging them the whole time, or the whole life they've lived with that. And that is why they have sort of turned that into a form of identity, you know, and that becomes sort of identity, sort of politics. So they're proud to be a Westie. So if you ask them, you know, what class are you in, for instance, which is sort of a bit of a silly question these days, that half of them are just as likely to say working class, and that would be because, you know, they believe that they pull themselves up by their bootstraps and they're different to those money people, you know, the middle class, wealthy, upper middle class people over there. So they're still, you know, they will identify sort of like that. And it's also to do with the culture. They love the beer out of the backyard, you know, they love the mates, they love the pool table instead of the formal dining room in the lounge. You know, it's a bit of a lifestyle thing as well. But they've been successful and they feel confident in their success. And so they are quite happy to have, as I say in that essay, one foot, you know, in the camp of the middle class, new middle class, and one in the foot of the working class, in the camp of the left.
Okay, there's a question here, then we go down there. Yep.
In your studies of the Harrington Parks of this world, is there any evidence as to the impact of or the influence of religion on their lives?
Mm. Question about the particular reference to Harrington Park as an example, the impact of religion.
The religion in southwest Sydney and parts of Western Sydney is less than in the northwest of Sydney, but where the values and religion meet is where their religion is at. So while it supports their family values and their work values, there's a religious sort of... But they're not as sort of... We don't have... In South West Sydney, there aren't as many of those sort of churches that they have sort of in the Baulkham Hills sort of district. There are some there. There's some quite fundamental churches sort of springing up. And there's a lot of religious schools, but... For the people that sort of send their kids there, send them for the values, not necessarily the fact that every subject's related back to the Bible.
Question there, yeah.
Yeah. In your research, have you found out what these people, you know, do they have an aspiration to move, say, to the North Shore, the Eastern Suburbs, together, more and more flats coming up on the North Shore, their island? Do they aspire to come there? And like Labour Party, people seem to end up in the North Shore, Eastern Suburbs, once they hit the top.
The question is whether people from Sydney's Western have an aspiration to head to the North Shore like some of their political people they've elected politically.
No, most people want to move further out onto acreage. That's their aspiration. If they could retire on acreage, they've made it.
So we go down there. Yeah.
Did you, in your research, come across saving these families have, or it was important, experience any financial hardship from an economic perspective? And if they're in
a question about the level of saving in the Western suburbs and whether people in the Western suburbs are better able to overcome forthcoming economic problems than those in the north and east of Sydney.
I have no idea. I don't know about the Eastern Suburbs or how much money they've got. They would have different investment ideas, and for the aspirations, they put their money into housing. They've been, over the years, this idea that you've got to look after yourself in your retirement. They understand property, so they put money into property. So they build a big home, which is capital gains tax-free, and that they will see that as their nest egg for when they retire. So even though it might look like they are, you know, grasping greedy materialists, there is actually a reason why they put so much money into their property and why they are so careful to protect their asset, and why they want to move to an area where everyone else is trying to protect their asset, because it is particularly as a lot of them are petty bourgeois, they have little businesses, an air conditioning business or whatever. A plumber or a cleaner or whatever, cleaning business. You know, that is the kernel of their retirement plan. So, and they understand property. Most thing property doesn't go down, unlike the stock exchange. And of course, property doesn't go down unless you want to sell it. So, most of them feel pretty comfortable with that.
Okay, remember a senior Labour politician saying to me once that he was surprised, he's from the West, but surprised about the amount of investment property that is owned by people living in the West. The second house, third house, what have you come across about that in your studies? Just talk about
that. Well, this isn't really exciting to go into how many houses they own. Most people in Harrington Park believe that eventually they would buy investment property. The two reasons I think that there are, and they're related, so many small landlords in Sydney is because they understand property and they can see it and they can feel it and they can drive past it whenever they're feeling economically vulnerable. And the other reason is because of the high numbers of migrant people out there. And they migrants in Western Sydney, most of them are lower socioeconomic, they were fairly unskilled when they came to the country. They didn't sort of get involved in the business side for the, you know, the thing to get lawyers and tax and all that sort of. They bought the property and then they bought another one and they could bring the relatives out and show them how successful they'd be because, you know, they had the, a property for each kid. So there's a very much a cultural kind of thing amongst a lot of migrant people, particularly from Southern European. I haven't seen the same with Asians. In Vietnamese as much, but certainly in the Southern Europeans after the Second World War. And that just becomes a cultural thing. And so all the kids have to get the big house and then they have to buy another house for their kids. And so a lot of it is actually buying and protecting their children, thinking that their children might be able to afford a property when they get older.
That's right down the back here.
Look, the second biggest thing that's happening in New South Wales and Sydney is that people are leaving.
The question is about the number of people who've been leaving New South Wales and in particular Sydney, and the question is why did some stay and not more leave in view of the cost of living within New South Wales?
That is a good question, because a lot of people moved up the Central Coast, and as that's become more expensive, you know, they sort of moved even further and further out. I suppose these people have got in at the right time. Someone asked about what happens to their children, maybe they're the group that migrate. Well, talking about Queensland, one of the things that a lot of them did do when they bought their extra property was buy up in Queensland. And the idea is that they might retire, not to Sydney Harbour, but if they're not going to get their acreage, then they'll move to Queensland. But, you know, their businesses are there, their kids are at school there. It's much more difficult just to migrate out of the place when you've got so many kind of networks and sort of structural issues sort of keeping you in place, particularly when you have small business. Or if you're in a job, particularly like public service, police, a lot of police and teachers, you know, they're going to go and start applying in a different state. So there are things like that that kind of keep people. It's more likely if you were more vulnerable in your employment, if you couldn't get a permanent job or whatever, then you might sort of be more likely to move out of the area. But if you've got the job and you've got the kids in the school and that, you know, and you're in your comfortable community, you tend not to move.
So we'll go over there and then we'll go there. Yeah.
I just want to go back to you saying that the next step is to go out to acreage. And I'm interested in what the attraction is there. Are they going out to small farms? I note that Mark Latham did that, and he's your kind of, you know, you see him as the epitome and truly of this kind of aspirational class. But it seems to me the older you get, the acreage seems to be, to me, would be a terrible burden, but I do understand it. What's behind that?
What's behind the quest for acreage and moving further west to get bigger land?
I'm only speculating, so I've no idea. I don't have an acreage, but I presume it's a lot of it's related to the children and the safety, and it's about privacy and not being crowded in suburbia, really, particularly as sort of the properties of lots have actually become quite small and the houses have got larger. The houses have got larger to try and capitalise on how expensive that little block of land is. I'm not really sure. I think someone needs to do some research on that. I think it's...
Because it's not new.
I've
lived up the north of the North Shore, and if you go back 100 years, Sydney was moving up to Hornsby, to Wetara, and those sort of areas. They're big old houses on big acreages, which became subdivided.
Yeah.
The same with the train line and then later the bridge.
Mm.
Like freeways, it's not new, but it's going further out.
I'm not sure if people do it as much for that reason now. I think that they actually do it now for the privacy kind of thing. But there was that idea like that you would buy that acreage and then you'd be able to subdivide and be really, really wealthy. So like a place like Edmondson Park, which is part of that Southwest Growth Corridor, that is all held by sort of little acres, 5 acres here and 5 acres there. It's very difficult to develop that kind of land. There's so many land holders have that. And like, say, Oran Park, which is just owned by, you know, like the one sort of group, subdivide that very easily. But that slows down sort of land release as well, because so many people in the past did sort of buy into this expecting to... And then they harass, you know, the local member for 10 years to try and get it released, and it's quite difficult to do, particularly now in this current sort of age where there's so much of the bureaucracy attached to land releases and infrastructure and all the rest of it.
Yep.
Gabriel, I went to Parramatta High School, raised there, and kids went to
Parramatta
High School.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm a Westie. When I go back there, I'm struck by the high proportion of non-Anglo-Saxons, and I was particularly struck at a University of Western Sydney graduation ceremony when I think the number of Anglo-Saxon names on the list of graduates was about 15%.
Mm.
Do you have any insights on the multiracial nature of Western Sydney?
Mm. The question about the multiracial nature of Western Sydney.
Yeah, Western Sydney has arcs of racial, multicultural sort of areas, and they stretch from sort of like Kingsgrove, Bankstown, through Holroyd, up to Auburn, Cabramatta, Fairfield, up to Parramatta. And that's sort of the middle ring suburbs. And in fact, strangely enough, that's also where the original mortgage defaults, you know, the Western Sydney's highest mortgage defaults, it actually is in that arc. So... yes, it's quite an interesting thing because they're quite. Their houses might not be that super cheap, but the type of employment, it's very non-English speaking, and you know, tend to take riskier kind of loans and all sorts of things like that. But the aspirational moving are trying to move away from that. They've seen their suburbs, their childhood suburbs, change as you've seen it, just so dramatically. And there's a physical change, and they talk about it, the smell's different, and it is, you know, there's a Turkish nut shop and it smells different to a,
to a cucumber sandwich shop.
Yeah, and they're trying to move away from that because they see that sort of threatens their ontological sort of security, and they move out to these. That's why those estates, these aspirational type of estates, tend to be quite homogenous in terms of the demographic.
And Anglo-Saxon?
Most of them, although I mean, it must have been a community could be anything. If you Chinese develop, like wanting, I mean, develop one that sort of encourages Chinese people to move in. But these ones are, you know, Lancome developed in relationship, in partnership with another sort of development group. So those sorts of areas that are left, Parramatta down to Bankstown, are quite high in terms of the non-English speaking multicultural, and a lot of those migrant groups. Most successful thing that they can do is send their children, their first generation, to go to university. The aspirationals, on the other hand, that's why I deliberately put that quote in here today, because the education is about values, not necessarily about going to university. And a lot of them, because they pull themselves up by their bootstraps, they don't actually trust the education system. So that if you've got an air conditioning business where you can earn $150,000, and your kid goes to university and becomes a teacher for 60, that doesn't sound quite right. So they don't trust the education system as much as other people. Whereas for migrant people, it's very important that the kids get an education, because it also proves to them that they made the right decision to come here, that they are able to give their kids a better life and all the rest of it as well.
The aspirational people you describe to my ears sound very fearful and very navel-gazing. When they are not in that fearful, internalising milieu, do they ever look up and out? And if they do, what do they see, do you think?
The suggestion is that the aspirationals are pretty fearful.
they're inward-looking.
And inward-looking, yeah.
Yes, that's I'm the one that's fearful and navel-gazing, which is why I'm here today talking about it. When they look up and out, they look at their community, and they are very community-oriented people. And they would feel that while they are looking after their family and while they are looking after the people in their community, that that's what they're supposed to do. And that's where this sort of value system lies. And it is easy to criticise them that they're not looking outwards. And I don't think they are particularly fearful, any more fearful than, you know, someone working in the stock exchange at the moment. but they didn't strike me. In fact, they struck me as being quite a happy bunch of people. You know, they were quite relaxed about things. They weren't sort of, you know, they didn't read a lot of newspapers, they couldn't watch the telly.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't sort of engaged in that way that other people are. But I don't think that I think we have to be a little bit careful about sort of mocking that. Because they have certain values which are good values and supportive values of their people in their community. They're not locked in to the global economy like other groups are in Sydney. So they don't tend to look out as much as that. When you live in Harrington Park, the global lights are a mighty long way away from your house. They don't have the infrastructure to be able to move over there. You know, there's reasons why people sort of drive their SUVs around Camden rather than sort of driving them over to the global art and getting involved in a job like that. You know, there's an isolation thing going on here because of the lack of infrastructure.
I'm going to finish very quickly. Go 1, 2, 3. I'll go 1, 2, 3. Just leading on. To what extent is, I mean, you sound, I must say, remarkably well adjusted. like me, of course. But if you look at the writings of Catherine Devaney, who writes every Wednesday in the Melbourne Age, who comes from Reservoir in the Melbourne Western Suburbs, I mean, she loathes the people in Melbourne West. She regards them as uneducated hicks. She uses the term Bogan. She seems to forget a lot of them used to buy the Melbourne Age once, but she really insults them. Now, we don't really have that kind of character, and I say someone who's come from the west of Sydney and absolutely loathes where they've come from. Are you aware of any such outlandish types? You're not one yourself, obviously.
Oh, I hope I'm not one myself. I mean, I just say people, you've got to take people as they are, you know, and kind of understand where they come from. That is my thing. Like, whether you're a Westie or you're a culturalist or whatever label you want to call yourself, and everyone has a story, and people in Western Sydney have a story, and some of those stories are quite extraordinary. And to be sort of assuming that everyone's sort of this homogenous group out there, you know, who are uncultured and uneducated, you know, they might have a different way of thinking, and, you know, sometimes their way of thinking is great. And sometimes it's annoying, but, you know, we're probably all like that. But as for whether I can pick someone, I'm not sure. I don't know whether I...
Must be a Melbourne thing. Okay.
the proliferation of schools that teach values rather than teach how to think... Doesn't that trap the aspirationals within Harrington Park and prevent them getting their acreage? And lead to... planes flying into buildings and Mumbai attacks and so on. I understand that's a big leap, but when people are taught values rather than how to analyse, I find that disturbing.
The question is whether teaching values lock people into something or other.
I think that's a bit of a slide on the teachers, actually. The teachers in these schools are fantastic. And I don't think there's any problem teaching the kids to analyse. Because I suppose it just depends where you put the emphasis rather than your ability to analyse. Kids' education these days, to be in these sorts of schools, is just, I think it's quite extraordinary. And when we talk about the education revolution, I think we should be talking about the way that we teach kids in lower socioeconomic state schools, where the one size fits all, that's where the problem lies, not in those.
Final question.
Gabriel, as you're describing the people you're talking about, it reminds me very much of Sarah Palin, the American election. And she was derided by the elites, by the elite academic mentality of the West or the East Coast. But she really fitted your description of small town, community-based democratic society. And although she'd been to university, she was treated as if she'd never been to university. Is it then the problem of this divide between those who are the inner city, pseudo outward-looking against that group that has really found the community mentality that we've all been saying we've lost.
It's a question about Sarah Palin as coming from small-town America and being derided by the elites. Okay. And any comparisons to here?
Well, oddly enough, the original research was actually looking at community formation in these that I was doing. LANCOM actually wanted me to have a look at community formation in these states, and they were trying to develop better community models. And because that whole kind of social capital, the whole Putnam-esque sort of stuff that came out was all about community, like, and when you finally have it, it's all, you know. Now, I mean, there are good things and bad things about community. You know, community, even though we talk about it as always sort of being this positive thing, it can be quite, you know, limiting, and it's quite an exclusionary thing. That's why it's a community, otherwise it would be a society. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about sort of glamorising community too much. I mean, there are good things and bad things about these, you know, just as there are good things and bad things about any sort of group or sort of structure, but I think we just have to be very careful about just being so critical. You know, that's the thing that is, I just find so annoying, that people get on their high horse and, you know, and start moralising about a group of people who, you know, I prefer to be seeing heaps of Harrington Parks out there than other groups of, people that we meet, some groups that we have in Western Sydney.
Many thanks. So, as I said, there's some copies. I've got some copies for sale of the Griffith Review that
$5 a copy.
Contains Dr. Gwither's chapter Once Were Westies, that's outside, and Gabrielle Gwither's done some very important work at the University of Western Sydney in recent years, and it's great that she's come along tonight to talk about some of her research. I'm sure there's more research to come, and I'm sure we'll have her back at the Sydney Institute again. But for tonight, thanks for a very informative and lively discussion.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.